Leaning, safe and secure from all alarms. Leaning on everlasting arms. There you go.
They will say that I have shed innocent blood. What's blood for, if not for shedding?
I just can't take no pleasure in killing. Just some things you gotta do. Don't mean you have to like it.
There's nothing to worry about. You're gonna be just fine. I'm your number one fan.
Let her get away, Mommy.
Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Welcome to another edition of Horrifying My Friends. I'm horror host Trav. Joining me, as always, is producer Kate.
Whoop whoop.
And joining us today is one of my favorite guests and one of my favorite people on this planet Earth.
Aww.
That's Sherry Scott.
Hello, hello.
It's picking her up now, isn't it? So I wanted to first cover, so we just got back from a blistering vacation. This will be the first HMF back, but we are back like fucking Batman, back from the grave. And I think the first day in Florida, I realized that Florida was not for me. But how was your guys' vacation?
Wait, first things first, it's your birthday today. We're recording on Travis's birthday. He is 31 years old.
I am, and I'm really hungover. hangovers hit hard at 31, and I'm never eating Thai food again. So that's like another horror. That's another horror.
He's tied. I'm
tied from Thai. So how was your guys' vacation and stuff? Did you guys have a similar experience to me? Because I know, like, after the first night, I was shivering, and Rose put a cold rag on my forehead and gave me Tylenol literally like an infant child. But I was like, I've never been hit by the heat like that.
You guys gave yourself sun poisoning.
Yes.
The heat was, I mean, the sun literally felt like it was burning a hole in your skin.
Yes.
It was just so hot. But once we were in the water, I spent most of my time in the water. It was amazing. But I had people put on the lotion really thick, and I just went out in the water like white. You guys did the spray on, and what you was you were wet. And I remember you were wet and you said, put this on. I sprayed him, and he was wet. And that's why you had so many splotches, I think.
Ooh, yeah, I had boils on my back. Yeah. Kate, what about you?
I didn't get burned at all. I was great. What made vacation a little bit difficult for me was that my 2-year-old, one, got sick, two, was a psychological terrorist on the drive up and the drive back.
Oh, the drive back. Oh, girl.
And so that, you know, but other than that, I had a nice time. I love being at the beach. I don't mind being hot in the sun. That's my kind of thing. So.
And then that second and third day, Rose looked like fucking Deacon Frost from Blade.
Oh my God.
Like, you remember the vampires when they all paint themselves white to go out and see, like, the Daywalker, how the Daywalker does it? It was hilarious, though. She looked like Jack Nicholson's Joker. Like, going out. She had, like, that white paint on. I was like, damn.
I saw her. She was crying. Mom, come put this on me. This lotion on me. And I wanted this. She was so red. I'm talking red, like, red. I was like, oh, girl.
But, yeah, in the meantime, I've been appearing on my brother's podcast, Fatal Follower Presents. But Horrifying My Friends is back with a vengeance. And today we are back with another edition of Classics Corner with Sherry Hagen. I figured we might come up with a little name for that.
Because
we're always kind of doing like a classic film. So this one is kind of... now, you said that this is Night of the Hunter from 1955. Now, at first, you didn't think that you'd seen it, but you said later on, think you have.
I think I was sitting in a rocking chair on my mom's lap when I was a little bitty, and I saw this movie, because I remembered bits and pieces only.
Yeah.
Like Robert Mitchum, his, like, buffoonery type looks, and his, you know, some of that is really all I remembered. And the scenery, The way it was so artificial and everything. That's what I mostly remembered. Mm-hmm. But then, so it was like, I know I've seen this, but I was so little, I don't remember the actual plot or the movie. But yeah.
So this is, in a sorts, like a, kind of like a review from all three of us. Because I had never seen this film up until a couple weeks ago. And I kind of texted these two in our little classics corner text message group. And I was like, we got to cover this movie. Because this movie, some of the shit in this movie is like terrifying. But yeah, this is The Night of the Hunter by from 1955, directed by Charles Laughton. Cinematography by Stanley Cortez. Music, creepy, creepy music throughout this by Walter Schumann. Sherry, this is where you can kind of input some of your history and stuff. But let's start with Robert Mitchum as the Reverend Harry Powell. A creepy, creepy character.
So many people would have played that character as a heavy and... not so, he was like edgy and, you know, evil would be so dark. Uh-huh. His evil was not played that way. It was a little lighter, a little edgier. There was humor in this insanity that I didn't expect. I didn't expect that. His yowling and his yelping in some parts, like it was a joke.
Like when he got shot and he started running
but
away?
Even throughout it all, it's like somebody said he was a pantomime of evil or whatever. And that's, kind of, I get that in a way.
It was interesting how much his kind of shtick changed the second time you saw it. So his shtick I'm talking about is... in the movie, not to like jump ahead of all the fast facts, but this is the guy playing the murderer, the killer. When you see his shtick, his like love hate shtick, explaining why a preacher has tattoos on his hands and not that he was in prison, you know, and he's doing this shtick for these folks in, where are they? Somewhere in West Virginia. Willa and Icy and all them, the really like dumb,
gullible,
dodo kind of people.
Gullible. Yeah.
And
small town gullible.
His delivery of that love hate thing was much more serious when he was telling them. Uh-huh. And then the second time he is doing it, trying to convince, you know, the woman who took in all the kids. What was her name? Miss Cooper?
Yes, I believe so.
Miss Cooper. When he's trying to tell her this, you know, love hate thing, like it comes off so disingenuous and fake. And like he thinks that she's an idiot, and it's so,
but she's a real religious person. She really gets the Bible, and she's a really good versus evil. She is the good soul in this. She saw right through him.
Right, she saw right through him, but it's because he was delivering it in a totally different way than he did to begin with. It was bullshit from the beginning, but like I think they purposefully must have directed him to make it even more, like, unbelievable.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think there's some of that in there.
I think part of that is the desperation the character was supposed to have in trying to get those kids to get the money. I think that desperation came through in the way he delivered it to them versus trying to charm charismatically the widow with all...
I think he knew the cards were stacked against him and that the kids probably have already warned her about him. And he almost has gotten lazy. I think he's told this story so many times at this point, trying to track them down and going from, you know, house to house, community to community, trying to find them, that he's just like phoning it in at that point. Anyway, I thought he did. That's all to say that I think the way he acted this role was like really, really good. And I guess I heard or I read in my, you know, very... lazy research on the film because I don't usually research. You usually do that, but I guess Robert Mitchum like really, really wanted this part, and it's one that when he looked back on his career, he said that was like his favorite, right?
Yeah, and like I read, and then we'll wrap up. Like I'll get it moving on the other members and stuff of the cast. But I read a lot about like that he had this bad boy persona and almost
he did.
Yeah, he got busted for smoking pot, but that almost helped him, you know, back in even the 40s. And then, like, he had this bad boy persona and almost like a, I don't give a shit, like, what I get and what I don't get. Like, he was one of the leading men in Hollywood that didn't really care about, like, the leading men movies and stuff.
Well, you know, you gotta, like, when I researched him a little bit, I had no idea that he was arrested at 14 and in a chain gang, and he escaped and went back to his family in Maryland. And then got married and worked for Lockheed. Mm-hmm. And lost his hearing, a lot of his hearing, and then had a nervous breakdown resulting in like blindness, and ended up having a nervous breakdown from the stress of the job.
Interesting.
And then went back to the acting part in like Hopalong Cassidy was, I remember Hopalong Cassidy, oh, yeah. I'm that old, but it repeats, but yeah, so he had bit villainous roles in that. So that was kind of his thing he went to. And of mm-hmm. course, him in Cape Fear was amazing.
Oh, yeah. I always thought he would have made a great Batman, but that's besides the point.
It is. Too late now.
Okay, so Robert Mitchum, Shelley Winters as Willa Harper. Willa! Lillian Gish as Rachel Cooper. Billy Chapin as John Harper. Sally Jane Bruce as Pearl Harper. And James Gleason as Uncle Bertie Steptoe. Plot synopsis. A religious fanatic marries a gullible widow whose young children are reluctant to tell him where the real daddy hid the $10,000 he'd stolen in a robbery. So, fast facts. This is based on a 1953 novel of the same name by Davis Grubb. Charles Laughton directed only two films, this and The Man on the Eiffel Tower. The latter was just kind of a hired gun situation, so really he only directed one film in his entire career. He was an actor and stuff, and directed, and was in a lot of stuff, and directed like a lot of theater and stuff. So there are two main reasons why Charles Laughton, like, and people will see this movie and be like, why the fuck didn't he direct more movies? Two main reasons he only directed this one film. Like I said, the Man on the Eiffel Tower was more of a hired gun situation. First was the film's negative reviews. Not everybody got the tone switches and stuff like that in this film and thought, you know, that he kind of missed the mark. And that really, really, he was a sensitive artist, so that really, really affected him. So he was like, he swore never to direct another movie. Second was that Charles preferred working in theater. He later stated that there you could constantly change and amend the production, you mm-hmm. know, adding lines and, you know, changing lighting and sets as you go. But with film, once it was done, you know, it could never be changed. And that was hard for him to watch. Robert, as Kate mentioned earlier, Robert Mitchum was very eager to take on the role of this preacher serial killer. Apparently during auditions, a moment that impressed Charles Laughton was when he described the character as a diabolical little shit, to which Mitchum answered, "Present!" this film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry. The Night of the Hunter is now considered one of the greatest films ever made. The film magazine Cahiers du Cinéma selected The Night of the Hunter in 2008 as the second best film of all time behind Citizen Kane, mm-hmm. which, you know, that's like their opinion, man. the film was shot in black and white in the styles and motifs of German Expressionism, like a lot of horror host Trav's favorite flicks. Stanley Cortez did a masterful job creating truly stunning images that deserve to be hung on my wall, any wall. Bizarre... Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. German Expressionism is kind of like bizarre shadows, stylized, distorted perspectives, surrealistic sets, odd camera angles to create a simplified and disturbing mood that really reflects the character of Powell. Think about like directors like Hitchcock and Tim Burton, you know, the more recent directors like that. Later on in life, Robert Mitchum stated that who was usually indifferent. Like I said, he had kind of like a who cares attitude. Kind
he
of thing.
Was an alcoholic and a avid marijuana user. So, you know, he just whatever.
Yeah, we'll judge him there. so, he actually said that Charles Laughton was his favorite director and indicated that this was one of his favorite movies which he had acted, which Kate mentioned earlier. I don't know if you guys knew this or not. Dutch-born American serial killer Harry Powers was the inspiration for The Preacher. Mm-hmm. Powers lured his victims through Lonely Hearts advertisements, claiming he was looking for love, but ultimately murdering them for their money.
He actually found his wife through the ads and then married her and then kept doing it.
Yeah, so I read a little bit about him because, you know, I love to learn about a new serial killer I never knew about. And... so they only found 5 bodies, but like in questioning, he's like, what would it matter? Because they found so many other like mm-hmm. people's possessions and stuff in his home that indicated that there were probably many, many more women that he killed.
Oh, yeah.
He's probably one of the most prolific, frankly, but they just don't have like hard evidence that he did. But he basically said something along the lines of, you know, they've already got me for five. What does it matter if there's 50 or more?
Yeah, and I think like that was a reference at the end of the film that they said like 25 widows or something, like when they're mm-hmm. when they're doing their business to the preacher man there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is all, you know, a very good segue, but I'll let you finish your fast facts to my speech I'm about to do.
Okay, all right. All right, so my last fast
history fact, lesson, if you will.
My last fast fact actually came about like 10 minutes ago because I was reading more and more about this film, and like this film kind of like captured me, and this is kind of what I love about being a film fan, is it's like, and this goes out to this goes to Sherry too, like we're always, and Kate, we're always discovering stuff from the past, you know, newer movies that come out, and it's like, holy shit, how have I never seen that movie before? And then I was texting Sherry about it, you know, but this is just one of those movies that stuck with me and really has stuck with me. Probably till the day I die, it'll stick with me. But the last fast fact is references to this film go on to this day. Most recently, the piece called Pearl's Dream, which was used in Night of the Hunter, obviously. The scene when they're out on that raft is used in Promising Young Woman. So
yeah, when Pearl's like singing, you know, and it almost sounds like she's in a bubble or something. It sounds
like a dreamscape type.
Yes.
Yeah, and she's section. Singing, you know, into this echoey dark night on a boat, and it's that song.
Yeah.
That's in the, what did you say, in Promising Young Woman. Yeah.
Yeah. So that wraps up my fast facts. Sherry, I know you got a lot written down, and Kate has speeches written up.
Kate has a speech.
So I'm really interested to see what you guys think about this film. So whoever wants to go first?
First impression?
Mom? Yeah, Kate. Let's get first impressions.
It wasn't the horror movie that I expected.
Mm-hmm. What did you expect?
I don't know. I didn't do any research before I watched it. I just watched it. And mm-hmm. I was thinking horror, like, you know, suspense, the Cape Fear, this. I mean, it was like a Southern Gothic novel is basically what I just watched, which was very cool because I didn't expect it. But the silhouettes, you know, I'm a big thing, you know, in some of the John Wayne movie, you know, there's the uh-huh. silhouettes and they were everywhere. Everything was light and dark. Mm-hmm. So it was very, like you said, the expressionistic film stuff. I thought that was really interesting. I liked the way the evil was not so in your face. It was, like I said, mm-hmm. the heavy part of it. It was more subtle. But I got a thing for religious fanatics, you know, in real life as far as, like,
You got a thing for
Bible them. Thumpers. You know, I find it very interesting how people can be manipulated and lured by that charismatic charm that they put out there. It's like, give us your money type thing. And so I think being a widow as well, mm-hmm. it sort of hit home a little bit for me. So mm-hmm. I delved more into that because it's kind of a thing for me. But one of the things when you're talking about religion, and I found it, it's Mark 12:38. And it says, beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and like greetings in the marketplaces and have the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation. So when you look at history with widows and the scribes, yeah. which
people who prey on widows are going to hell.
Basically. They are. Yeah. But that is as old as time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they used to, scribes being preachers, you know, these type mm-hmm. things, basically used to tell widows, even wealthy widows, if you'll just give us your money, you won't be able to be kept. Mm-hmm. Because back then, you got remarried and you were kept. You were property. The patriarchy.
Yeah, I got more on the patriarchy. Yeah. Do you want me to?
Being married then and almost even now protects you from that.
Sounds like you're describing a horror movie,
Sherry. It protects you from that. And supposedly. When I became a widow, mm-hmm. the same thing kind of happened. Only different now where it was small towns and you was like, oh, the new widow, boop, you know. And it was more more social media type thing as well. And man, the minute you put widow on there, you are, the vultures come in and they go after you hard.
Everyone comes out of the woodwork.
And what I found interesting too is like when Shelley Winter's character, Willa, mm-hmm. is, you know, before the preacher, when the preacher comes to town, you see her in the candy shop with the older couple, and she seems happy. Mm-hmm. She seems like she's in a good mood. She seems at peace with her grief and her loss and her life. And then the preacher comes to town, and I saw her look a little weary of him, a little leery, like, you know, he's, I don't think so. Where Icy's in the background going, girl, you need a husband. You got to go after, you know, she's pushing and pushing. They're pushing the poor widow. You need a man. Mm-hmm. You need a man. You need a man. Mm-hmm. And then finally she's like, oh, I don't know. And then she pushes her over to, at the park to go sit by the lake. And one of my favorite quotes is, when Icy, one of them is when Icy goes back to the picnic table after she pushes Willa to go sit with the preacher. And she says, a husband is one piece of store goods you never know until you get them home and unwrap them.
Ooh.
And I thought that was funny. I like that. But so that, and then the fact that he was so charismatic and charming. And then on the wedding night, it's like, no, you know, yep. Your body, look at your body. He's insulting her. Look at your body. What you are, what you're good
yeah,
for.
Yeah, you're basically a whore. All you're here for is to make babies.
Your body's for, for getting children, not lust. But then he calls her, oh my God, this is one of my favorites, is he says, she's the spawn of the devil's own strumpet. I love
the word strumpet. I really do. So I'm going to piggyback off of something Mom brought up, which is like the patriarchy and kind of like providing some historical context to the world women were living in at the time this movie was made. And presumably
it was based in the 30s, though.
This is facts from the 50s, so it was even worse in the 30s. But, mm-hmm. you know, here's it what was. You need to know. So not only is our patriarchal society at that time and, you know, now in a lot of ways to blame for the whole plot of this even being able to exist, right? So one, it made this psychopath think women are inferior to him. And then two, you've got this society making women believe that once widowed, they cannot survive. Mm-hmm. And it actually built a structure that makes it almost impossible for them to survive mm-hmm. and support their families on their own. So I looked up things women by law could not do back then. Women could not get a credit card on their own. They could not decide not to have sex with their husband, meaning spousal rape was considered not rape. There was no recourse. Women could not get health insurance on their own. It wasn't until the 60s, 1960s, women could get their own bank accounts without a man. So Willa probably wouldn't have been able to get a bank account.
Well, it's also, remember during the Depression, there was less bank accounts and more just putting the cash under your bed.
Right. I've got more. So they weren't protected from being fired if they were pregnant, and not protected from discrimination in hiring if they had kids already. Mm. And even teachers were forced to leave work once they were showing if they were pregnant. Oh. Anyway, but most importantly, during the Great Depression, which this is taking place in the Great Depression, mm-hmm. Married women were literally lawfully banned from working at a certain point
mm-hmm.
because they were basically the scapegoat. Like, you don't need to work, so like you're taking up all these jobs.
You stay home, you take care of your husband, you take care of your kids, you do stay in the barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen.
Right. So they were a scapegoat, right? So single women could work, but not in jobs. And this is just in addition. Single women could work, but not in jobs that paid a living wage most of the time. Or that could support a family, obviously. This is the whole point of this movie. So they're basically at the mercy of people's charity, right? Mm-hmm. So at this moment, Willa is at the mercy of Icy and her husband's charity. And Icy's like, you can't do this on your own. You need a man. And basically, I'm sick of taking care of you, so go get a husband.
But even nowadays, there are so many widows that are not fortunate widows, I guess is a way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're preyed on. And yes, they are pushed and told the same things even today. Mm-hmm. And it still happens today.
Yeah. So if you put yourself in Willa's shoes, and I think it's unfair Willa is painted. I mean, her character is super gullible, but I think it's unfair to assume that all women back then were like this, right? If you're in her shoes, it's either live on people's charity and the pittance that you make in the ice cream shop mm-hmm. to raise two children in a depression or get married. The odds were stacked against you to even go to college at this point. So
you've got to remember too, with small towns, which in West Virginia, small towns, Everybody knows each other. And to be honest with you, especially the back then, people look after their own. She would have been taken care of no matter what by the community in a lot of ways. But
didn't sound like it. Sounded like Icy was ready to punt her to the curb if she didn't get a husband.
I just think that so many people fell so hard for his bullshit so fast. And he's a preacher. You know, when preacher comes to town, it's a big deal in small towns back then. It was a huge deal. So they just believed and they fell in with that charismatic bullshit. And they were like, oh, he'd be perfect. You need him, you know, and keep him around. You marry him, not just for you, but he's going to stay.
Right, but this is what was frustrating for me with Willa's character. Not just that she was dumb as a box of rocks and completely easily brainwashable. It's that she was like brainless and gutless. Like, name it. She was it. Mm-hmm. And one of my notes says she better snap two at some point and protect her kids.
Well, she didn't, though.
And she didn't. Not once. She watched them be abused and just kind of raised her eyebrows. That was the most she did to protect her kids.
She didn't believe her kids.
Mom, and then she laid down and waited for him. Like, literally watched him stab her to death.
Took a slap.
Not even thinking, my kids are next, you know?
Yeah, and I think they set that up, too, because, and Sherry mentioned this earlier, like the... I can't remember the word that you used, but like maybe like the underprivileged widow as well, because the kid's real dad, you got to remember, was like a bank robber or whatever he got that money from. So it gives this it kind of sets it up to where like the people of the town are even like, oh, like the last dad wasn't, you know, a good guy, but this guy is a preacher.
You saw the kids in the park, at the playground, talking about singing the hangman song. And
another creepy song.
The hangman done.
And then the kids are outside the wall, and you can tell that they're singing that about their dad, and because he had just been hung. And then you hear she pulled him out of school. So because of all of it, but yet she stayed in the town. She stayed there with her kids. And what was shocking to me was when she finally disappears. Mm-hmm. They believe this preacher that says, oh, she ran off and left the kids. She just ran off. If she was going to run off, she'd have run off when her husband got hung, you know, so they believe the preacher and not the person they had known probably her whole life, which speaks to how gullible these people and brainwashed they were by this cult leader. But the one of the things Shelley Winters said, which, by the way, I only know Shelley Winters from The Poseidon Adventure, by the way. But she said she played the character like the spider to the fly to the spider. And I think she did an amazing job, because you see how he tells her she's the spawn of Satan's devil's strumpet or whatever. But then they show the little bit parts of his congregation, and he's fire and brimstone. He's up there preaching and the Protestant stuff. And then you see her doing the same thing.
That scene was spooky as fuck.
Yeah, you see her almost, those eyes, she looked literally like a psychopath, just schizophrenic person.
And I love how he's in the background, like just standing like this. And he just, says like, amen. You know, like,
basically, look at my creation.
Oh.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know what, Jim Jones, we can go on about these leaders.
Yeah.
But she was when I looked at, like I said, that was one of the things I looked into, because the religious aspect with the widows and the towns and all that. And then, of course, having my own feelings and thoughts on it, too, which I had, you know, in the beginning. But, you know, it's like I saw it and I felt it and I was unsure. I had panic attacks at night. I had nightmares over it. All of those things. But, you know, at one point I stood up and thought, you know, remember who the fuck you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what Willa didn't do. She just went with the flow.
We don't know anything about Willa's background. We don't know anything about the preacher's background either, other than that he's a psychopath. Like, we don't know what made him that way. But clearly,
mental illness.
Yeah, but it seems like Willa is just one of many generations of dingbat dodo women raised to not have a backbone and to accept whatever men give them. And to believe whatever, you know, men say to her. And it's not just men. I think this is the danger of blindly believing in anything, including faith. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
you can be manipulated if you aren't skeptical at all about anything.
And you saw it in Lillian Gish's character, Miss Cooper, whatever. Miss Cooper. You saw that the women, there were women that were strong back then. Oh, yeah, there were independent women that stepped up and did the right thing. And they weren't gullible. You know why? Because they learned early on, you don't trust nobody.
I mean, you can trust. There are certain people I think you can easily trust. Like, it's proven to you in their actions, you know. But, like, you can't trust strangers.
I think also to give Willa a little bit of credit. I know she is portrayed, like, as weak a lot in this film. But I think, like, she didn't just get duped by anybody. Like, I think he is a force. Like, he's a pro. He's done this to... Like at the very beginning scene, well now, what's it to be, Lord? Another widow? How many has it been? 6, 12? I just remember.
He's driving through that.
Oh, that scene, man, when he's talking to God. And then he's just like, the widow with a little wad of bills hid away in the sugar bowl. Lord, I am tired. Sometimes I wonder if you really understand. Not that you mind the killings. Your book is full of killings. Like, I love that scene, man. But, well, like, this guy is a, like, bona fide predator.
From the get-go, my favorite, I have to say, my favorite scene is in prison when he, out of nowhere, leans over the bottom of the bed and he goes, where, Ben? Where?
Yeah.
I was like, that set the whole tone for me for the whole movie. It was so creepy.
Uh-huh.
Well, speaking of my first impression, which I never got to because I had to go on my spiel about the patriarchy and historical oppression of women. But anyway, so this movie starts out actually with floating heads in space,
uh-huh.
which when I saw that, I was like, what?
Mm-hmm. It's like a David Lynch.
Yeah, I was like, this is wild. Like, I didn't know I was going to be watching something like this, right? And it's, you find out later, obviously, it's Miss Cooper talking to all of her little kids that she has, you know, her orphan kids she's mm-hmm. adopted, teaching them stuff about the Lord. And she, and like the ultimate message of what she's saying in that scene is like, what'd she say? A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, and an evil tree cannot bring forth good fruit. Wherefore, by their fruits, ye shall know them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this whole movie, like Mom said, it's black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Evil and good versus good. It's
light, dark, all of it.
Yeah, light, dark. It's very absolute. Mm-hmm. There's like, they don't really go for characters that have like a gray middle ground very often.
No, they don't really have time for it. It's kind of like one of those, mm-hmm. like you said, a gothic, southern gothic.
Yeah.
It's like one of those, and I couldn't help but think like Cormac McCarthy, you know, Flannery O'Connor, like some of those old authors. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it almost doesn't have time for it. It's good and evil and we're on the run mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah, there's some stories, you see the movies that are 2 hours long and they have the beginning, the middle, and the end. You know, there's the, it gives you the lead up to why Mitchum's character is the way he is. Then it was no. Their budget was $600,000. Mm-hmm. They had a very low budget.
Well, so, and they told off back then, a lot of the time, very linear stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, from what I've understood from someone older than me, Mom, who read the book.
Really?
The Southern Gothic was exactly what the book was. And the movie was very on point to
you
that.
You know what? A more modern movie this kind of reminded me of. And kind of, not like in a... Not totally, but like, and I mentioned the Coen brothers before, but like, what was that fucking movie? No Country for Old Men, another Cormac McCarthy,
good one.
Where it's like this dude just going around with a cattle prodder or whatever the fuck he had, cattle gun or whatever. And it's like, he bad and the good and you running.
Yes, pretty much.
But yeah, like, so what did you think? Like, did you think that this movie did, and we mentioned Promising Young Woman earlier, but the author in, let me find that article, where they talk about the song being used. So this is the Vulture article written by Jackson McHenry, but he's talking about how these two films kind of go hand in hand as like mirror images of each other. And that was like on purpose to the director because he's like a huge Night of the Hunter fan. But did you think that the film was like progressive for its time in its depictions of like, you know, on all these themes that we're talking about? Like, did you think that it did that on purpose, like showing how manipulative he could be and stuff like that?
Do I think it was progressive for its time?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I want to say yes. The problem is that I never lived in that time, so I don't know what it's like to have the mindset of a woman in the 1950s. You know what I'm saying?
If you're doing, though, an overall of the whole film itself,
yeah,
I didn't do any research as to what films were being made in 55. I would assume they were, you know, post-war, probably a lot of musicals even. This sort of went back to almost like the silent film mm-hmm. era. So I think progressive in that respect, that it went backwards in a way. It sort of was an homage to that in a way.
Yeah, but and a lot of film noirs were popular at the time, like Mitchum being in Out of the Past.
Yeah.
Like one of those is a big film from his catalog. But like we got the weaker woman, as you mm-hmm. guys said, like in Willa, and then we got the, like you said, the good Christian as the Mrs. Cooper,
the good
who
evil.
Is having none of his shit. So that's why I was kind of like.
So she's the antithesis of Willa, right?
Yes.
So when you ask, do I think this movie was progressive for its time? You know, probably. It's an. Mm-hmm. I don't know if its intention was to be, mm-hmm. But I think its messages. You know, while I have some issues with even some of the final good messages, which is like, you know, if you're a good Christian, whatever. But like,
yeah.
But the message that, you know, women should be able to be independent and should know how to protect themselves and recognize bad men.
Mm-hmm.
And that people in general should take care of the children and love the children.
Takes a village, so to speak.
Yeah. Like those are all messages I can get behind. And I would hope that audiences of that time learn something from it. But I suspect that it was like a lot of audiences back then had so much internalized misogyny, internalized patriarchy, you know, like that they were just probably like, you know, that's just the way things are. And Miss Cooper just happened to be like a really cool lady. Like, but there, I don't think there were a lot of like women in the 1950s, you know, housewives, you know, especially the ones that are like living comfortably in this, you know, system built for them,
mm-hmm.
the nuclear family and everything. Like, the I don't think that they were like, you know what, I'm gonna go back to school and become independent from my husband. Screw my husband. Like, I don't think that was.
I think it holds true to this day that people can watch that, but unless they were a widow or lived in a small town, they wouldn't get it. A lot of the Protestant preachers back then, this is exactly what they preached. It's exactly what they did. So, and I think when you see some of those people, if you research it, it's hard to tell that a real one from the delusional one who thinks that he's doing the Lord's work mm-hmm. by killing, you know, widows.
Evil masquerading.
Oh, yeah. What does he say? He said at one point, there are too many of them. Can't kill them all.
Yeah.
Can't kill a world. That's what he said.
Yeah.
What does he say? Like lacy things?
So he would literally kill all women if he could, is what you find out.
You could tell
on.
He hated women.
Mm. Yeah, and I know we're not into scenes yet. We can be if you guys want.
Yeah.
But that scene early on when he's at that burlesque show, and I can't remember the quote that he says, but he says
through.
Like lacy things, and he has the hate fist.
Curly-headed things.
Yeah. It zooms in on his hate fist, and he like clenches a fist and then like puts it in his pocket, and he's just sitting there like disgust.
And mm-hmm. a knife pops out. I think he got a boner from it, but he hated it.
Well,
and I
it
hated
could be.
It.
Oh,
and that's
yeah.
why the knife
yeah.
pops out. Mm-hmm. I think that was like a...
The vast majority of psychopathic men who are they're serial killers.
Absolutely.
And they kill women, they get sexual gratification from mm-hmm. the
yeah,
murdering
so
women.
I was like, he was watching that, the knife popped, and it was the first thing. I was like, mm-hmm, I know, we know what you are.
Oh, yeah.
This was straight up a morality fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Straight up. That's all it was.
Absolutely.
And I have to say, I kind of like that. And... They were, like I said, there's so many things. It was almost a cautionary tale of what not to fall for, what not to believe in a total stranger you don't know. Don't be so gullible. Don't be so naive.
Yeah,
remember
don't
who
become
you are.
The next, you know, cult member.
Don't be a victim. All of it.
Right,
yeah.
But, and I think this movie did so much. Like, not only does it, you know, bring up all these topics that are super prevalent now, which, you know, a movie is good when however many decades later you can watch it and still get a lot of like really deep messages out of it, but they also showed John,
yeah.
the little
yeah.
boy.
Great actor, by the way. That little boy was really good in this.
The little
I
boy John, amazing. But they show this child with PTSD, and mm-hmm. you can't imagine the amount of trauma that not just these kids went through, but countless. Like, there must have been thousands and thousands of kids in the Great Depression, in that era. Period.
To be a child and have to step up to be a man,
and that was
and not knowing how, and being told not to tell about the secret,
Well, no, they were literally just being turned away from people's doors, given a potato, and be like, get out of here.
Yeah.
And this is a lot of what Miss Cooper is saying when she's talking to herself in the end. Like, children are so resilient, they can endure. It's amazing what they can endure. And it's like, yeah, but they're going to be fucked up adults.
Yeah, she says, and Rose actually, like, loved Mrs. Cooper, like, as a character.
She's a great character.
Yeah, and like you said, the kids will probably be messed up, but it's like Miss Cooper's at least doing what she can. It's like,
oh, no, of course, yeah. Without her, they'd be much worse off. Like, the world needs Miss Coopers, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm.
And she says, another quote from her that I really liked was, I'm a strong tree with breeches for many birds. I'm good for something in this old world, and I know it, too.
Well, and that's one of those things when you talk about Bible thumping the religious. This is one crazy psychopath side of it, and then she believes in the Bible. She's reading the Bible to him and stuff. But what she's taken out of it is what people should take out of it, which is morality. It's a moral code to live by, and that's what she's trying to live by, mm-hmm. and that's why she's taking in kids when they're not hers, and she's being kind, and she's not judging them or anyone else. Even the preacher, she was kind to in a way, you know, in the way she spoke to him.
And you would hope that she wouldn't be teaching the kids all the messed up shit in the Bible, but what she was telling them and what they showed us was her taking, you know, stories from the Bible and teaching these kids lessons that they can, one, see themselves reflected mm-hmm. in.
Exactly.
But also that can help not just help them with their own personal morality, but help them understand the world a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these kids have gotten hard lessons already.
So this is just, in a way for me, it is a way, you saw how someone who's a fanatic and mentally ill can interpret the Bible mm-hmm. in a horrible, horrible way, like he did.
A zealot,
And then someone who can interpret it how they want to, in many ways, is the joyful part, the good part of it.
And I think I think it was you that touched on it. And obviously, like, none of us are, like, of age to talk about that era, but like somebody like Memes definitely probably could.
Yeah, I talked to her a little bit.
But it's like, think about that era, and I think one of you guys brought it up, like the 40s and 50s, the Depression, the war, you know, a lot of these children were just kind of like on their own, like, in this world.
Well, they were expected to work. I mean,
yeah, a lot of children back then, especially you're talking West Virginia, you're talking farms, you're talking those type of things.
Oh, yeah.
The holler.
Yeah.
Don't waller in the holler. Don't waller in the holler, people. But no, in all honesty, children were only children for so long mm-hmm. back in the 30s, especially in the country, in small towns. Mm-hmm. I think that they stepped up to become, they were definitely adult before their own time and expected to take on a lot of responsibility before their own time. But yeah, it was an interesting movie in a lot of ways. I liked a lot of it, but...
So let's go around and give, like, our favorite scenes and stuff.
Yeah.
Because we gotta focus on, like, some of the beautiful, beautiful shots in this movie, or, you know, some of the perfect scenes put together.
I think the most beautiful shot to me that was, I don't know, and I wouldn't say it's beautiful, but it was hauntingly beautiful in a way, was Shelley Winters, Willa, in the car in the lake.
Dude.
I didn't expect that shot, and I didn't expect it to be beautiful. She's dead. Mm-hmm. You know, she was murdered, but she looks so at peace.
In the fairy, like you said, the fairy tale music, like that melodic music going on.
Yeah, there was.
I told Kate before the show, I was like, that is one of those scenes that, like, will forever be in my mind.
So much artificial, so much natural put into the film. The difference was stark. It was definitely.
Yeah, so for me in that scene, Travis and I were texting after I watched it. I was like, wow, that scene.
Oh, did you?
The one you're talking about. Yeah. I think it was like her hair and the kelp mm-hmm. both like flowing in the water, and she's so still, like every part of her's frozen because she's dead.
That was a dummy, by the way. That looked fucking so real.
Like her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you see that she's tied down into the car.
She's tied, yeah.
And you see the slit, the slice on her neck. And there's just something about the music and the very the time that they took just to show you that scene.
Mm-hmm. And It was a long scene.
Yeah, and I don't know. That will never not be chilling.
And right before that is when we get that famous, like, what's on the cover of the film when he's like got his arms and he's like looking like that,
mm-hmm.
and he says, She'll not be back, I reckon. I'm safe in promising you that. I tried to save her, but the devil wins sometimes. Can't nobody say I didn't do my best to save her. Mm-hmm. And then it goes into that shot.
I think if you look at horror movies, even at that time, and horror movies nowadays, you know, if they would have shown that scene, there would have been decaying body. There would have been so much more to it. It was so very simple, but so poignant. It was that was a great scene, I thought.
I think you hit it on the head, like the beauty, the beautiful horror of that scene. Like,
yeah, and I think it's almost what makes it horror. There's a lot of chilling, disturbing, you know, subtly horrific things, which I'll talk about another scene in a minute, but that scene in particular where you see a dead woman tied up at the bottom of a lake is undeniably a scene from a horror film.
You know, at one point, like when she took the slap and she just lay down and she was waiting for him to kill her, there's a lot of widows that just want to wait for that to happen. So honest, in a way, I think she was ready to just go. And she was okay with that. Mm-hmm. I honestly, in a way, she looked so at peace with what was coming, and she knew it was coming. And she was at peace with it. And then when they showed her in the car, she still looked at peace.
And Kate, go ahead and give your scene, because I don't want to steal your...
Yeah. I don't want to steal your thunder. So another super chilling scene, horror-wise, obviously the scene mom's talking about where she's about to get literally stabbed to death, that's horror. The dead woman at the bottom of the lake, that's obviously horror. But some other horrific things that I noticed in this film, scenes, I should say, that gave me the chills up my spine, were one of the first scenes where the kids are in their beds and they hear leaning, leaning. First they see his silhouette, shadow on the wall.
And that song was prevalent throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, so they see his shadow on the wall. He is literally outside of their home. This is before they've met him. And he's singing that leaning song, and he's like a shark circling his prey, right? And what's makes it so scary to me is that he knows he could go right in. It's kind of irony, right? He knows he can go in and do whatever horrible things he wants to the kids and the mom, for whatever reason he wants to do it. But the kids have no idea what kind of danger they're in.
No.
Like, they see it, and they're curious, and they go back to bed. And the fact that they don't know what danger they're in, like, as a mother...
At that point.
...is, like, really, really, like, just chilling and scary.
I think I wrote down, John is the only smart one in this film.
John's on his ass from the get-go.
Because John was on his ass from the get-go. John was suspicious from the get-go, and it wasn't just about the money. It was that he was licensed to protect his sister and his mom, and that's exactly the persona he gave off in the whole... from the beginning to end in the movie. So in the basement, you can see it's like, the money's under that rock. It's under that stone. He was already trying to trap him down there and get away, you know? John saw it from the get-go.
See, I think the humor of some of those scenes, like, make him even creepier. It's almost like a Freddy Krueger kind of vibe thing.
He's a pantomime villain is what I read. I was like, that is exactly true.
Rose died laughing at that line when he's just like, what does he say? Shit, he's like, I can feel myself getting awful mad.
Oh my God. Could you imagine being a kid and having no control over the man who married your mom, who's now supposed to be your dad and you're supposed to obey him? Do you imagine the fear? And that's what that leaning whenever he would, or as he would skulk around and he'd do that smarmy, now children, you know?
It was literally him hunting them down in the house saying, children.
And the little girl's like, oh, but he's our new daddy. And John's like, no, he's not. There's something wrong with this dude. So in the first thing I wrote is John is the only strong, smart one throughout the whole movie until you get Miss Cook or Miss Cooper. So that was the first thing I wrote down, and that he's a psychopath and some other things.
Mm-hmm. Trav, what about you? We've been talking a lot. What's another one of your favorites?
So my two favorite scenes is Shelley Winter's character under the water, of course. Mm-hmm. And then my other favorite scene is when he's about to kill Shelley Winters and he kind of walks over to the light, and it's a beautifully lit shot. And he's just like standing up looking into the light, and he kind of does like one of these like weird things.
He does a weird thing.
He's holding his hand above his head towards the light that's coming through like a skylight almost, or like the in the window.
And that ceiling
almost
was...
like he's calling upon the power of God to kill this woman.
And the ceiling with the light and the dark, it was so tall.
And beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, because they're in the
and
attic.
He's basically holding his hand up to the light, and then it almost just like clicks on him, and he gets his knife and just clicks it open, like nonchalant, like totally nonchalantly, and then walks over and like, you know, it doesn't show it, but he walks over and stabs her. But that scene is so fucked up. I remember watching that like at night by myself, and I'm just like, what is he doing in that light, man? It's like so bizarre.
But as you're watching it and you feel the fear, you feel the sadness, you feel all of those things, but at the same time you're looking at all the stuff that all the whole film in general, and it's so beautiful you almost lose track of the horror of it, because you're like that scene in particular. It was kind of weird. I mean, I didn't feel that horror, you know, like, oh, here comes a murderer. He's going to kill her. It was more like, oh, wow, look what he's doing. Look at the ceiling. Look, I was looking at all the lights and the darks and the silhouettes. And really, her being murdered was like the last thing I really thought of when I watched that scene. It was kind of weird how they did that.
Another scene I knew that you would probably like was it seems like there was a reference to Stagecoach. Or not, maybe it's not. Is it Stagecoach where you see through the door of the John Wayne movie?
The silhouette.
Yeah, the silhouette. And it's
not
the silhouette.
It's little the Searchers.
The Searchers. Yes. The Searchers. I had to go back. You see the silhouette of him, and he's singing, of course, and he's walking on his horse, you know, out in the middle of the night. And I think I think they're in the barn, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That interesting fun fact. This is from the IMDb trivia. Like, I'm not special for figuring this out. Apparently, that shot of him on the horse with the silhouette, like with them in the barn in the distance, was actually forced perspective, meaning they hired a little person to sit on a pony.
Interesting.
I didn't know that.
So it wasn't actually him.
Interesting.
But anyway, some fun facts about how the sausage gets made.
I still think my favorite scene is when he leans over the bed. That's your first real view of him. I think it is like he leans over the bed and asks Ben, where's the money? Basically, where, Ben? That look on his face as he's hanging over, it was just like, that was one of the creepiest things for me. It was like, that dude is not right.
Yeah, Mitchum fucking rocked this role.
I think he did.
Yeah.
I have one more scene that actually it's brought a tear to my eye.
Okay, let's hear it.
This is the ending. It's at the end. It's Christmas. The kids are all at Miss Cooper's house, and you see John. He wants to give something back to Miss Cooper. At that moment, I think he's realizing how lucky he is to have her and how grateful he feels to have her. And obviously, it's the Depression. He's a kid. Like, he has nothing to his name. All the money's gone at this point because I'm sure the cops took it. He goes in and gets an apple, wraps it up in a doily, makes it look nice, and hands it to her. And just that gesture and watching Miss Cooper's reaction to it, like, I literally cried.
It was such a simple... And it goes back to when she said, go get yourself an apple. Go get me an apple, too. Go get me one. Go get yourself one, too. And then he came in and she... So it was sort of back to that. It was like, she offered this to me, I'm going to offer it back. Almost like she gave me that love, I'm going to give it back.
Yeah.
In a way.
It was a gesture
of love.
You want
to go a little deeper, yeah.
And yeah, just that.
For sure. So Sherry, do you want to give your rating of The Night of the Hunter out of 5?
I think because, like I said, being a widow, it hit a lot more points for me. I would give it a 5 just because of, you've got religion, you got the schizophrenic, mentally ill guy, you've got the fanatic, you know, Bible thump. You got the whole thing. So
they fit a lot in this movie.
There's in this movie. And I watched it twice and I stopped it and I nitpicked each scene. And what would that mean to me? So I watched it just for the fun of it the first time and wrote down my initial responses to, like, look at that ceiling. That looks like my God, she's already in a mausoleum. You know, he's going to kill her. So in the basement, all these scenes. And then I went back and watched it and nitpicked certain things, like the widow and how Icy's her comments and some of those things and all of those things. And then the horror aspect of it on top of it all, the cinema, it's the way everything was, the light, the dark, all of it. The silhouettes, I'm a big fan of all that anyway. I'd give it a 5. It hit a lot for me.
Kate?
I think I give this a 4.5 out of 5. So for movies to get a 5 out of 5 from me, I certainly think it's 5 out of 5 quality. But for me, my personal rating system, a five has to be something I will watch over and over again a lot and never get bored of it. Mm-hmm. And like, I actually get excited about watching it for the 100th time. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't one of those for me, but it is a damn good movie. It's so good. I hear when I hear a lot of people talk about classic film, this is not one I typically hear the title of.
No, never.
But it should absolutely be up there with, you know, people who are like, have you seen Citizen Kane and all that other shit? You know, like, it's one of those that you should definitely watch.
I mean, this was said to be Mitchum's best performance.
I think it is, personally. Like, I haven't seen every one of his movies, but yeah. So they actually released, this is free on Prime and free on Tubi, and they actually, the best edition of this to get, though, is the Criterion Blu-ray, which is available at, like, Barnes & Noble and stuff like that. But they put out, like, a banging edition of it. Yeah, this would have to be a 5 out of 5 for me, too. I agree, Sherry. Robert Mitchum, I think, gives, like, a chilling, chilling performance. And, like, it kind of reminds me of Blue Velvet a little bit and his, like, kind of delivery and performance. It kind of reminds me of Freddy Krueger. Like, there's a bunch of shit going on. Like, even the humor is creepy.
Slow and steady. Yeah. And that humor, just that, like I said, so much of it was in there, not just the yelping and the yowling, but there was a lot of humor in it, which he did so creepily that it was, I don't know. It was crazy.
Like, even that scene when he's like, don't touch my knife, little lamb, because that makes me very angry. Yeah. And, you know, stuff like that. It's like, oh, God.
Creepy.
But yeah, this would have to be a 5 out of 5 for me. If you want to see this film, definitely go check out the Blu-ray in the Criterion edition.
But watch it more than once.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Sherry, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been
an awesome
edition of Horrifying My Friends. I do have a book recommendation. And since we mentioned Southern Gothics earlier, I wanted to recommend Cormac McCarthy's Child of God. This book is incredibly messed up. Cormac McCarthy is, you know, Blood Meridian, No Country for Old Men. Very, very, very good author. It's the synopsis. In this taut, chilling novel, Lester Ballard, a violent, dispossessed man falsely accused of rape, haunts the hill country of East Tennessee when he is released from jail. While telling his story, Cormac McCarthy depicts the most sordid aspects of life with dignity, humor, and characteristic lyrical brilliance. So it's kind of like in that... That synopsis is a little like, it's about a serial killer that gets out of jail. It's about a serial killer that gets out of jail and he's like roaming fucking, you know, East Tennessee. But yeah.
Something about the South.
Yeah. These Southern Gothic, almost fairy tale like.
It's the Bible Belt.
But yeah, thank you for joining us, Sherry.
Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us to the return of Horrifying My Friends. As always, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Horrifying My Friends and at Horrifying MF on Twitter. Catch me also at Captain Creature on YouTube and Twitter. Have a creepy week.
Bye. Happy birthday. Horrifying My Friends.